Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Yeah, welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. We got a couple of our favorites on the program here today. Got Marty Scoveland Jr. and Joe Kent here. D'Anthony, which order do you put them in? Who's your favorite?
I don't do favorites.
Really?
No.
I do. I do it with my kids. I do it with my family members. And I do it with guests. And right now, it's Joe Kent. I'm going to be honest with you. Marty, yes, I've known you for years. But Joe is much better looking.
If I had to pick between Joe and I would also pick Joe. Yeah. So we're on the same page there.
Yeah, pop on over to Joe here. Pop Joe up on screen versus Marty. Joe, where you at? You got to talk for me. It'll cut through.
Right here.
There it is.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There it is. So now you've seen both of them on screen. Obviously, Joe, that's why you're the favorite. I always judge my favorites on if I had to fuck another dude in this life. It's obviously going to be you. Like, Marty's not going to be a fun one to wake up next to.
I do have breakfast.
We're off to a good start here.
Well, welcome to Drinking Bros. You know the story here. Obviously, you remember Joe Kent on the program. You ran for Congress. Was it 2 years ago?
Well, I never stopped, so I'm running again. Started in 21 and then fell just a little bit short in 22. So right back on the campaign trail.
Yeah, so we were following it. A true story here. I was actually talking about you last week. We had Tulsi Gabbard on the show. We've had a ton of politicians over the years. And one of our listeners at the Range Day event was like, out of all the candidates you've had on the show, who do you think could actually make a difference in the world and change what's happening in our current political system? And I was like, man, if I'm being real, there was a guy named Joe Kent. And when you were on the show a couple years ago, when you were running last time, everything that you said, your look, everything about you and the way you speak to people, you seem like the politician, like a guy who could be president. My wife just left the room and I was like, stay with this guy. This guy looks like he could be president of the United States one day. You ran on the right things, in my opinion. What happened in that last election and how close was it?
So that's really close. In the general, it was less than a percentage point, about 2,600 votes. We had to do a recount and all that type of stuff. So I ran against a 12-year incumbent in the primary who was backed by millions of dollars from the Republican establishment, beat her, which is pretty challenging to do. And then we had a pretty fractured Republican Party. We have really late primaries here. I wish we had primaries like you guys in Texas that are kind of early in March. So once the primary was over, we had a lot of, unfortunately, hard to heal feelings at the end of the primary. So the party was very divided. The Democrats were smart. They sat back. They watched the Republican bloodbath. And then they nailed me with $6 million when I was flat broke in negative ads. But despite that, we still only fell short by about 2,600 votes. So once the recount was over, we just announced the campaign all over again.
Awesome. And then for this year, how's it looking? Do you get pre-polls already? We're about 7 months out for the election.
Yeah, it's looking pretty good. I mean, this is the top seat to flip. President Trump won our district in 16 and in 20 by about 4 or 5 points. My opponent ran basically as a moderate, but now that she actually has a record, she had the luxury last time of saying pretty much whatever she wanted because she didn't have a record. But now that she's been in Congress for almost 2 years, her record is pretty much identical to Nancy Pelosi and AOC. So we're really just focusing on the abundance of bad votes that she's taken in terms of inflation, the open border, protection of our kids, war, all that type of stuff she's horrible on. So highlighting her record, and I think we'll be in a good spot. But we're, you know, working hard, pounding on doors and doing town halls.
Speaking of war, you've done some war.
A little bit.
I have. Marty has. Ross was at the Olive Garden.
I saw. Yeah, 4 tours of Italy at the Olive Garden.
It's a different kind of war, but you know,
I've got manicotti shells stuck inside of me, and I've said this multiple times, and I've never been able to get them out.
If you see close-ups of his toenails, there's still red sauce underneath them.
Sure is
from stomping out all those tomatoes. At any rate, it seems like there is and we all know about the Uniparty. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but this is the since the early 2000s, this is the biggest push I've seen from neocon and leftists to get us into some fucking wars. Like, all weekend, the press was like, oh, fucking, they're shooting, the Russians are shooting rays at us now and giving us AIDS or whatever the fuck. It's like, shut the fuck up, man. Nobody believes this shit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But what, how do you read that? I know the Trump side is, I to be honest, I think his foreign policy in some regards is very sophisticated, like the Abraham Accords, for example. And I think in other regards, it is extremely naive in the sense that we haven't made a massive economic push to reestablish the supply chain for our microprocessors through South America and Central America, instead of like cobalt and lithium in those places, production up the coast and stuff like that, more like a Monroe Doctrine thing. Now, I know you're something of an anti-interventionalist, I guess to some degree. So what's going on aside from just the obvious money? Like, I know a lot of people need to buy summer homes and shit, so they're waiting for this Raytheon money to come in. But aside from just that, what the fuck is going on in D.C. right now? I don't get it. I mean, when you see, I posted this the other day, when Republicans and Democrats work together, Americans typically lose, right?
100%. Whenever you hear Washington, D.C. say we've got a bipartisan solution, that's time to check your wallet and then be prepared for us to get involved in a war somewhere, probably in a country that you've never heard of. So there's the bipartisan consensus right now, unfortunately. The good news is we're kind of moving the needle with the Republican caucus. If you look at just 2 years ago when this all started, the majority of Republicans in the House supported us just giving a blank check to Ukraine. Now we've got House Republicans that are fighting to prevent the bills from even going on the floor. So I think we're in a better spot there. But look, I mean, at the most basic level, everybody in Washington, D.C. benefits from there being war, especially a war like Ukraine, where they're fighting this trench warfare, more of a conventional type of fight, because that allows the defense contractors to sell, you know, 155 shells, artillery pieces, aircraft, those types of things. And then that money goes right back into the coffers of the congressmen and senators who support that. But then I think you have a much deeper seated national security blob, deep state, whatever you want to call it, the unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. I think you've got a lethal combination of old Cold Warriors who knew the Russia threat really, really well. The global war on terror kind of distract them a little bit from that. But now they sort of feel like they're back, because Putin plays such a good, you know, evil guy to turn your ire on. But then you've also got this desire from a lot of folks like the Victoria Nulands and the Kagans that want us to continue to push NATO up onto the border to provoke a confrontation with Russia. And a lot of that goes back to the incentive structure from the military industrial complex. But I think a lot of these people truly believe that we need to be spreading our version of democracy through the barrel of a gun, despite the fact that that's like never, ever worked before. And then if you look at the ramifications, they've just been absolutely catastrophic, not just for the Ukrainian people. I mean, Ukraine's lost probably a generation of their young men, if not even more. But then also the fact that Russia and China are now aligned because we threw this massive sanctions package at Russia. We're seeing de-dollarization throughout the entire world. So I think we've really bitten off more than we can chew in terms of our debt, in terms of depleting our military industrial base, but then also in terms of what this is doing right now to the dollar. We're playing right into China's hands.
Yeah, 100%. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Marty, you do a lot of, you write a lot, you do a lot of research. You're usually pretty up to speed on things that are going on in the world. Do you think that that propaganda is just more obvious now, or that it's actually increased? Because I'm not sure if it's always been like this. I know social media allows for quite a bit more daily programming and shit, but it seems like we're in a whole different world now.
I think that the people responsible for pushing propaganda, I think there's the same amount of those people around today as there were in generations past when we look at it. But I think that the opportunities to use propaganda as a tool are much more numerous than they've ever been, because of the fact of, hey, before all you had to work with was books, newspapers, magazine, you know, traditional print media, and then evolved into, well, now we've got radio we can work with, now we've got TV we can work with, and now we've added this entirely new dimension of social media. And it's not like there's just one platform. There's multiple different platforms just in the United States, never mind, you know, there's different platforms that are specific to China, specific to Russia, places like that. So I think that yes, from like a strictly a volume perspective, there's more propaganda today than at any other point in human history. but I think that the people pulling the strings or you pulling the levers to use propaganda to, you know, arrive at their desired end state, I think there's the same amount of them as there has ever been, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you listen to, well, actually, there's a good book on this. It's called The Attention Merchants. I don't know if you've ever read it before. It's by Tim Wu. I've mentioned him on the show quite a few times, actually. But he basically tracks how early 20th century politicians in America kind of took their game plan on propagandizing the public with, like, the same stuff Trump does sometimes, like the clever names, like, oh, fucking Lion Hillary or whatever the fuck he says.
Crooked Joe Biden, yeah, yeah. Sleepy Chuck Todd.
Sleepy everybody, yeah. But they took that stuff from snake oil salesmen in the late 19th century, right? And they turned it into political advertising. And then Madison Avenue actually took it from early 20th century politicians and turned it into actual advertising, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I definitely agree with you. It's not new. I don't think the volume is definitely different, but that's, you know, just math, right? There's more people, well, and there's more avenues.
Yeah. And you just think too, like if you were a, you know, I feel like propaganda, you, at least on the international stage, used to be primarily a tool for the most powerful nations on earth. Now you've got nations that are, you could be in sub-Saharan Africa and find your place on the world stage. Because of the tools that are available to people now. And Joe could probably talk a lot more about that than I could, but like there's a certain amount of democratization of propaganda as a tool that's happened because of, you know, the technological advances we've had over the past 20 years.
Yeah. Joe, you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. If you have an internet connection or even just a smartphone with decent reception, you can play on that stage. I mean, I think another thing, especially pertaining to the Russia-Ukraine amount of propaganda we're seeing out of that that conflict and how we're being told that if we don't blindly support that, then we must be secret Putin stooges. I think a lot of that just really highlights how, you know, it's cliche to say that we're highly polarized, but I do think that there's been this massive merger between social media and the government and a lot of the intelligence agencies. And because of the Twitter files, we actually got to see a lot of that in real time. We got to see behind the scenes what a lot of us already thought was going on. But I think it's just much more brazen now. And because the environment, and especially in an election year with people like Trump and Biden, is so highly polarized, you now have people that I think are willing to not look at any kind of objective evidence and just say, well, my team is supporting this one thing, so therefore I'm going to support it. And the media is also very good at saying, hey, if you question this narrative, in particular when it comes to war, we will label you as a Putin propagandist, a Putin stooge. And, you know, that has a decent amount of effect on people, especially if they hear it over and over again. Some people will become inoculated to it. But for folks who don't live in this space every single day, it's still a very powerful tool. And the media has a way of making coordinated attacks against people, you know, through articles or just labeling someone an election denier or a Putin stooge in a way that, you know, if there was just traditional newspapers before, I think it was a little bit harder to do.
Yeah, I mean, the rapidity at which the message travels depends on a lot of things. But one of the primary things it depends on is like second, third order modality. So like word of mouth, for example, right? Word of mouth used to be somebody watched or somebody showed up to my event and heard me say something about the other guy or the other country or whatever it is, or they saw it in the newspaper, or they saw it on the broadcast news, and they told three or four other people. Now you have hundreds, if not thousands, of quote-unquote influencers on the internet, some of whom are not even real people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of them. Remember that blonde chick that was allegedly a Biden staffer from last year that got exposed to not even be a real fucking person?
Yeah, yeah.
There's hundreds or thousands of these people who have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of followers who can fucking amplify these messages ad nauseum, essentially, to a massive audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, where this is a whole new fucking ballgame now. And I like, part of me understands why the government would want to put the kibosh on that bullshit, right? Because it is dangerous that people that there's so much bullshit propaganda out there. But you can't control that. Like, you'll never be able to control the voice. It's never worked in all of human history. Anybody, like, every revolution is based on some leader, politician, or otherwise going after dissenting voices
mm-hmm.
and failing at it. Almost every revolution in the history of human beings, like even ours, John Adams gets, after the Boston Massacre, gets those guys off and of murder charges, and then the Crown decides to bring all court cases back to England anyways, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that plus the taxation thing, we're like, fuck you, right? We're not doing that. I don't understand how, once again, we think we're going to do something that's been historically ineffective, and it's, well, this time it's going to work, right?
And how do you convince people, Joe, like for you running right now, how do you convince people that you're different and it's not going to be the same shit that we've had for the last, you know, 100 years or whatever? Because that's probably got to be one of the most difficult parts, right?
It's challenging. I mean, unfortunately, elections, like I lost by less than a percentage point. And a lot of that comes down to who's going to get the most money, who can get the most clicks and the most eyeballs. Because unfortunately, there's still a lot of folks, especially in close races, that they're going to kind of go off the last ad or the most repetitive ad they've heard, which is usually fear mongering against the other person, as opposed to saying what your platform is. So I do get the sense, though, that a lot of people, especially folks who might lean a little bit more conservative, whatever you want to call it, that understand there is a uniparty, I think a lot of them are looking for alternative outlets to get their media from. And so whether they're gravitating more towards X now that it's a little bit freer, they look at podcasts, or especially I was impressed in my last election that as we got down to crunch time, especially in the primary, when people had five Republicans, including a 12-year incumbent to choose from, there was a lot of people who were just like, man, I'm sick of listening to the media. I want to come listen to you talk. Mm-hmm. And I have questions I want to ask you, because these are just folks who are done, you know, with hearing from the media. But that probably is my biggest obstacle, to be honest with you. We have to raise the money in order to be able to punch through the mainstream media. I mean, I've already got the New York Times and the Huff Post and all these guys coming after me, which I wear as a badge of honor. However, it is still something that we really have to push back against hard. And it's easy to get drowned out if you don't have the money to compete. And even if you do have the money to compete, as a conservative, you're definitely at a disadvantage, because the mainstream media is going to swarm attack you once you actually present a threat to them.
Absolutely. And, you know, we'll go back to some of these comforting phrases that Dan was alluding to earlier, because what Trump does is, you're 100% correct. All these phrases were from the 1800s, mm-hmm. Either from politicians that were running, and it, you know, they still had the press back then. It was just very limited, but it was a catchy, you know, title, at least in the article. Make America Great Again was actually used by Ronald Reagan in 79 when he was running against Carter. That's when he first started it, headed into 80 there. And everybody thinks it's, no, oh, it's MAGA. No, that was a phrase that Reagan used on all those, his campaign buttons and all that other stuff. Do you have a fun, flirty phrase that you're going out with here? Like, Kent, stop me now? Or, I mean, what are you workshopping here that we can kind of get behind?
I might need to steal that one, man. I might need to crowdsource a catchy phrase. So, like, as far as a phrase or like a buzzword, I honestly really don't have one. I try and go out and just be as authentic as I possibly can with people. But again, in soundbite world, you're right, that doesn't work out as well. Trump did a very good job with the catchy phrases, but then I think Trump also did a good job of saying things that were provocative enough that the media would actually cover what he said. And then it sort of had the boomerang effect on the media, where they're like, oh, we thought that we were going to be able to crucify this guy based on what he said, but that actually resonates with a lot of people. That's something that I think only Trump can uniquely do himself. I've seen other people try to replicate it, and it's just not the same thing. So for me, I try and go a little bit more, you know, content heavy with, you know, here's who I am, here's what I stand for. But yeah, if anybody's got any ideas for catchy phrases, man, let me have them.
Can't stop, won't stop. I'm just saying.
I don't know if I would use Diddy.
Yeah, we can't do it. Sorry. Diddy's going through some legal issues.
He's involved in some things.
Yeah. Dang it, man. Yeah. Can't buy me love. I mean, there's a lot we could do with this here. maybe throw in, is it Clark? Is that your middle name?
It's Clay, but everybody always thinks it's Clark, so sometimes I just don't correct people.
Change it. You kind of look like Superman. I would go Kent, you know, Clark Kent, obviously, for that one. But you have the good looks, so you could pull it off. And that's fun. What I'm surprised at is, in the middle of an election, which we hope you will win, and we're anticipating a victory out of you here in November, that you and Marty had the time to write a book. I've talked about this ad nauseum on this show. Writing a book is a fucking massive, massive uphill climb the entire time until it's out. The day that it's out is the day that you can celebrate, when they can't print it anymore, can't make any edits to the audiobook, all that other stuff. And this one is about your wife, which is even more important. Tell us about Send Me the Incredible True Story of a Mother at War that's coming out here on May 7th.
Yeah, so it's a book about my late wife, Shannon Kent, who was killed in Syria fighting ISIS in 2019. She was killed with three other Americans conducting special operations. And so after she was killed, I wanted the opportunity to tell her story, you know, for a couple of different reasons. Mostly, I really wanted there to be a way for my sons. They were one and three when she was killed. And so they never really fully got to know their mom. And I wanted there to be a way for them to understand who she was, you know, why she served, and for them to have something that they could kind of consume on their own, you know, beyond just the stories and all that that me and our family share with them. So that was the first reason. But then Shannon had a pretty exceptional career. I mean, she was a woman in special operations way before women were technically allowed in special operations. She never, you know, would tell you that herself when she was alive. She always kind of felt like she was, you know, just sort of there doing her job, very humble. But I wanted to share her story because I think it's something that's important to document, but then also to tell the story of a lot of other women who fought and served alongside of us who haven't really gotten a chance to tell their story yet. After that, I, you know, linked up with Marty, thanks to Black Rifle, and I wrote the parts about our family and Shannon as relationships, and then Marty did the deep dive, the investigative journalism on Shannon's entire life, really.
Marty, having written a biography myself, I know it's extremely difficult because often you have to ask the subject matter about essentially the worst day of his entire life. How hard was that for you as a writer to sit down and do those interviews with your friends, but asking about his wife that's deceased, knowing how important this book is going to be to his kids?
Well, I'll go all the way back to when we were first working on the article, and Evan connected Joe and I, and I came down for Shannon's memorial at the Naval Academy and met with Joe for the first time at he and Shannon's house. And I was fully expecting to walk in knowing like, hey, this is a grieving, Gold Star husband who just lost his wife. I was kind of expecting the worst walking in there. But to Joe's credit, I don't know how you do this, Joe, and how you were able to do it from the get-go, but very mission focused on I'm here to tell Shannon's story and do that right. And there's almost like there was no time for me to focus on my emotions, but we need to make sure we get Shannon's story correct. And that was right from the get-go with the article. So every time I've talked to Joe, it's always been like I've always felt very comfortable with, hey man, can you tell me about this, or can you tell me about that, or can you clarify this, and not having to worry about maybe ruining the rest of Joe's day. And if I have, Joe, you haven't let on that I did or anything like that. You know, he's been great to work with on that front. And there's even been a few times where I've said like, hey, I'm sorry that I'm talking about you and your wife like your characters, but you are, as far as it pertains to this book, you know, and we have to approach it that way. Everybody, so Joe is kind of in a category of his own, as far as I'm concerned, in my experience in working on the parts of the book that I did. Very easy to work with. Everybody else, I mean, there were some really tough conversations. There were some things where I got off the phone or off the Zoom call and kind of had to take a breather for a second there, because I knew, hey, I probably just ruined this person's day or brought up some really painful memories. It's not easy to do, but also Ross, it's not easy writing a book. You don't sign up to do that thinking it's going to be an easy thing. But in Shannon's particular case, it's worth every bit of effort that we put into it because it is an important story.
Absolutely. It's just incredibly difficult to tell. And I remember sitting with Marcus Luttrell after the first time he was on Drinking Bros way back in the day. We were hanging out afterwards having dinner, and I was asking him about his life because he does a bunch of speaking engagements, you know, obviously as does Joe. And I said, with that, you know, obviously you're compensated for it, but is it difficult reliving the worst day of your life over and over and over again? And he goes, that's the hardest part about all of this. And he goes, I understand that people want to hear the story, so I know what it is, but I'm reliving that day, you know, 200 days out of the year, or how many, you know, speaking engagements you have throughout the year. And with you, Joe, I've got to imagine it's similar. Obviously, you guys have the book coming out on May 7th, but, you know, a movie was based on your wife as well. What's that been like? Because now this has been years. that your wife has been talked about. Is that a happy or a sad thing for you?
A mix of emotions. There hasn't been a movie directly made about her. She's a character. She's a referenced in a few different movies.
Correct.
But hopefully the book goes well, and it'll eventually, you know, become a movie. But no, you're right. It's a weird thing, because sometimes it's a happy memory. Sometimes it's a painful memory. It's always kind of a cocktail of emotions, for lack of a better term, kind of an emotional roller coaster. And you know, I don't talk about Shannon as much on the campaign trail anymore, because I think a lot of people are familiar with me and they know my backstory. But people will ask me, like, how did you get involved in politics? And that inevitably leads me to talking about Shannon and you know, how she was killed. And so that's, yeah, I mean, it's hard, because I'm proud of her. We've got a lot of happy memories that we discuss in the book, but at the same time, I 100% agree with what Marcus said. You do have to rehash the worst days, you know, of your life. And you have to do it justice too, because I think as a guy who's in the military for a while, I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing things. But at the same time, when I discuss it, I want to do it the proper justice. So it can definitely take a toll. It can definitely kind of drain you, as much as I try not to show that publicly. It can be pretty taxing.
Yeah. And you know, going back to the movie element of this, I'm assuming they didn't reach out for you for life rights or any of that stuff. It's just kind of known in the community that is your wife who's being portrayed in all of this stuff. Did you see the movies?
No. Which one do you mean?
What was the one in God bless it?
Well, there's a series called Lioness.
Yeah,
that is.
Yes, yeah. So yes. That one, yeah. I don't think anyone reached out to me on that one. The what's the show called? This Is Us.
Yes.
The folks that put that together, there's one character who's a female human intelligence operator, and they talked to me about her, and they loosely based it on Shannon. But I didn't like do any kind of technical consulting. They kind of asked me permission to say that, hey, this is this person, this character is based off of Shannon. And I said, yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's so hopefully we actually get to, you know, do a movie where Send Me is depicted on the big screen, because that'd be a great way to share it.
That's that's what I hope too, because, you know, you see her, it's alluding to her in these other series and things like that. It would be awesome if it was his own standalone biography. So that was out into the world. And especially today with Hollywood, I mean, a female driven military movie would be a massive success.
Well, it's like, this woman lived the life that Hollywood has been trying to tell a story about, but has failed repeatedly at telling. Yep. But she lived the actual goddamn life. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I mean, it's the stuff that this woman did is incredible, frankly. And a lot of people in the community reference her as one of, if not the greatest assets in the war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're talking about hundreds of shitheads deleted from the planet because of this woman's efforts, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, what we get instead are like female rehashes of old classic movies, right? Or like completely retarded
Ghostbusters.
Unrealistic nonsense. Yeah,
female Ghostbusters.
You know what I mean? It's like this is the shit that irritates me about the shallowness of the modern feminist movement, right? Because it's not about actual women. As a matter of fact, it's mostly about men now who are pretending to be women, frankly.
Yeah.
But like, it's not about actual women anymore. It's not about real human beings and elevating their stories. People who've done incredible things. Now it's just like a fucking fantasy world. Like, no, there's subject matter to draw from here. What are you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, it drives me nuts. And I guess a lot of people now know something, if not a lot, about Shannon's story. But you mentioned it, Joe, before. She was the first in the modern age to do something like this. Like, maybe there's examples before. I don't really know. But in the GWAT, there wasn't anything like this prior to Shannon, right?
Yeah, there may have been some women here and there. When Shannon like kind of came up and really cut her teeth, women technically were not allowed to be on the front lines. But if you served over there, the front lines were pretty much everywhere. And Shannon initially deployed because she was an Arabic linguist and a signals intelligence person. But she really was invited to go work down at the ground level, in particular with special operations and SEAL teams. because she could speak the language really well, and she was very proficient at her craft. And that was kind of, I think, the theme of the early years of the global war on terror, where we were trying to operationalize intelligence. We were trying to move at the speed of the battlefield. And if you had linguistic abilities, or you had the ability to enhance our ability to run down bad guys and kill them, then we didn't really care who you were. We brought you in and made you part of the team. So when Shannon was included in all this, it wasn't because the Navy SEALs and special operations were like, well, I guess we got to include women. So whichever woman can run the fastest and do the most pull-ups, I guess we'll take. It was like, hey, this person who happens to be a woman speaks Arabic. She can get information out of Iraqis. She's competent enough for us to take on missions. And that gave her a role there. So I think she was in that small cadre of women who I think really earned their spot before other women were given really even just the opportunity to even try out for the team.
Yeah, and then for you, Joe, I mean, you obviously weren't side by side with her throughout all of her career there. How do you get the true story about some of this stuff? Or was she able to tell you as this was going on?
So I knew the high parts. We had met briefly in 2007. I actually went to a briefing that she was giving on where some bad guys were. We talk about that in the book, but we met for 10 minutes and I didn't see her again for many years until we ended up in the same unit. But I mean, Shannon and I really bonded on our common experiences in the war, because deploying was so much of, you know, our lives. So I kind of knew the high parts, but that's really where Marty came in and did hundreds of hours of interviews. And I always, at this point, I always forget that Marty didn't actually know Shannon, because he's gotten back and done so many interviews. So Marty did the deep dive, did the FOIAs, really got some unique access because of his background. So I actually, in the parts of the book that Marty wrote, I actually learned a good deal about specifically what Shannon was doing.
Wow. And Marty, for you, I would have to imagine, you know, having gone through this with the DOD and everything else, trying to clear all this information because of all the crazy shit she did had to have been incredibly difficult. Who else did you sit down and interview to confirm some of these stories?
So to just talk a little bit about the process there, interviewed over 40 different people, went through every document I could get my hands on. Also relied on Joe and I's background in a lot of the same corners that Shannon was in. I like to cite one specific example. Shannon is, there's a picture of Shannon literally standing outside of my room in Baghdad, like the CHU that I was in, like literally standing right outside. I can see my room in the background. Like, so I don't know that I ever crossed paths with her. I'm certain that I didn't know her. I mean, did we cross each other's paths in the DFAC or something at some point? Like, maybe. I wouldn't have known it. But it really was just trying to reconstruct as much as we possibly could to tell her truth. But yeah, I mean, when you're talking about somebody's life who most of their professional life is still very highly classified, mm-hmm. We had to try to pick out, well, what are the aspects of her job that we can talk about, be genuine to her story and what she did and the impact that she did, without betraying the trust of the special operations community, without putting anybody that she worked with that's still out doing the hard work in any sort of danger. I mean, that's a difficult thing. And you look at, hey, when we first started working on this book, it was like we signed the book deal and then like a month later, COVID and all that stuff kicked off. So all of a sudden, like, I wasn't able to travel in those early days there to go do interviews. You know, a lot of these people that Shannon associated with, they're not too keen to talk to any reporter, never mind over Zoom or a phone call or something. So it was kind of difficult there. And there were various stages of this. I'll give you guys the exclusive on this. There was that one point in this where I called Joe and was like, hey, dude, if you need to like move on to somebody else or something, like, I totally get it, because I was hitting wall after wall and felt like I wasn't doing her story justice. We eventually broke through that. And I can't thank Joe enough for continuing to believe in me and being able to tell the story. But like, yeah, it wasn't easy when you've got somebody who you never knew in real life, whose husband only knew the last, you know, at least firsthand experience wise, the last 7 years of her life. And then her family, because of her work, didn't know this entire, like, nobody knew all of Shannon. So how do you, and then so much of her life was classified. How do you write a book about that? What you see in this book is our best effort at overcoming those obstacles.
Yeah, because, you know, even filing for like FOIA requests and all that other stuff, it's time consuming. It's not overnight. It takes forever. And then trying to go through the DOD, is a fucking goddamn nightmare that is endless. And then trying to decide what you can write, what's got to be redacted, and all that other stuff. What was the breakthrough for you personally as a writer that you were able to get to the other side of this and say, okay, now I know how to put this all together and get this out into the world and tell an honest, true story about this American hero?
I frankly just had a couple of lucky breaks where one person wouldn't talk to me, but I would look them up, find their social media profile, find their mutual friends, try to reach out to those mutual friends, try to knock on enough doors to where somebody would answer. Ended up finding enough of the right people that were willing to talk and explain some of that stuff to me and fill in some of the gaps there, because there were entire deployments where I didn't have a single point of contact for until very late in the process, until two years into writing the book, where I was like, oh, finally I've got somebody that can talk about her third deployment, you know, and we just needed to fill in those gaps there. You know, the family parts of it are somewhat easy because that's, again, Joe can speak to that. Her parents, the au pair that Joe and Shannon had, that is now actually part of the Kent family, right, Joe? They were all, that was sort of the easy part, right? Like, as far as like getting those people to talk and tell all the great stories about Shannon. But a lot of these guys who are, and you also consider the fact that not just the COVID stuff, that was an initial bump, but also most of her career was spent in NSW. Well, again, you look back what happened right around the time that we started working on this, but you know, all the Eddie Gallagher stuff and a bunch of different things that happened in NSW that made them as an organization sort of clamp down. And if you were a SEAL, anything currently serving or veteran, you kind of knew like, hey, I need to keep my mouth shut for a while and lay low. And that includes even talking about a close friend that gave her life for the country, because I just, you know, they got to put food on the table for their kids too. Sure. And, you know, there were careers being threatened over talking to the media for a period there, for sure.
Yeah. I imagine it must have been interesting to talk to people who to you were strangers, and maybe Joe can has experienced this as well. Joe, these people are strangers, but you have this connectivity because of Shannon and the operations that she did, and I guess more so the person rather that she was. Like, you think of someone's emotional blueprint, and people can be wildly different from their home life to their work life. That's certainly true. But typically speaking, if you go far enough into it, you'll find overarching principles that guide both of those things, right? Kind of reminds me of We Were Soldiers when the guy asked, I think it was that dick from American Pie, asked Mel Gibson what he thought about being a soldier and a father. He said something to the effect of, I would like to think that doing one makes me better at the other, right? Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of those conversations must have brought you back to the same general idea, which is who Shannon was as a human being. And it seems to have been defined by a singular thing, and that's service. And that's why you named the book Send Me, right? Obviously a reference to Isaiah 6:8. You know, so I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And then I said, here I am, send me, right? Now, that it's obvious that that applies to warfare on behalf of your country, but you know, I think that idea of personal sacrifice and service is something that defines good human beings no matter what role they're in, right? And I assume that you saw a lot of overlap in her personality from the strangers you spoke to about her military operations and the stories you heard from her family.
Yeah, the two definitely, I mean, overlap. That's a big reason why I wanted to, you know, write the book and then have the two perspectives, mine firsthand and then Marty doing the investigative background. Because something that's hard for me is like, how do you reconcile, you know, the life that we lived and having a family at the same time? And to both of us, the two really intersected and overlapped. I mean, the reason why we were serving our country is because we loved it. Yeah, we professionally loved our jobs as well. But especially as we were discussing like what I was going to do after the military and what Shannon was going to do going on this last deployment, we knew that we had some off ramps and we could, our lives could have gone a different direction. But at the same time, we both had this feeling that, hey, if someone's going to go forward for our country and have to make these sacrifices and potentially give their lives, like why not us? We have all the skills. Why would we send other people forward to go do that if we're not going to do it ourselves? And so that's something I want to convey, you know, back to especially our sons as they read the book and as they get older and mature.
How much of the book, when you guys were finished, Joe, did you go back and read that you didn't know about your own wife?
Yeah, good deal, honestly. So especially some of her early deployments, like I knew the high points. I knew like the years that she was roughly in Iraq, and I was in Iraq a lot. So I kind of knew what was going on big picture. But as far as the details, you know, I mean, I think when veterans talk, we just have a general way of saying like, hey, were you at this base? And like, yeah, you remember that one year was kind of crazy. We didn't get into the details. So I didn't know a lot of the specifics that Marty uncovered. That's why a lot of times, like I said, I forget that Marty did not actually know Shannon. So yeah, especially her early life, high school, college, and then her first couple deployments, a lot, I'd say probably 75-80% of that was new.
No shit. How wild is that? Yeah. After all that's happened, to read a book about your wife and not know 75% of her life, essentially.
Yeah, no, most people don't ever have to, luckily, most people don't ever have to go back and attempt to be this accurate with someone's life, and they don't have to go and do, you know, FOIA requests and interview different witnesses and stuff like that. But when someone's gone, it is a kind of a very nice thing to have, especially for my sons, because if they just had to go based off what I knew and what our families know, like Marty pointed out, there would be a big gap there because so much of what she did was secret. And Shannon was very, very humble. I mean, she did not talk about what she did professionally. So her parents, my parents, a lot of folks just sort of thought that, yeah, she speaks Arabic, so maybe she translates some stuff at the embassy. They had no idea what she was doing. So it's been really a blessing in disguise to have this actually, you know, documented in a way that, you know, my sons can really get to know their mom in a way that I think a lot of children don't get to know their parents.
And for you, Marty, as a writer, how much of it do you think you didn't get because you couldn't get past certain classified documents, or perhaps you couldn't pull the right interview?
Well, I think that there will be at least the potential for a more complete story to be told about Shannon in 25 mm-hmm. to 50 years. You look at how long it took for somebody like Virginia Hall's life, who was an OSS operative in World War II. We briefly mentioned her in the book. It was 50 plus years before you really found out what Virginia Hall was doing. And I think Shannon is going to be mentioned in the same breath as people like Virginia Hall. If I get it my way, it'll be people like Virginia Hall are mentioned in the same breath as Shannon Kent. But I think that there is a lot on there. Just as some broad strokes here, when we talked about her job, we chose to focus on her linguistic abilities as well as her human intelligence collection abilities, because those are things that you can talk about in some level of detail without being hung up by OPSEC or PERSEC. Everything that she was doing on the tech side, the signals intelligence side, the cyber side, when you look at it like percentage wise of what her job was, that was a massive part of her job that is just completely omitted from the book. So I don't know if I could assign a percentage of like what percentage of her life isn't in this book. I don't know, but it's a lot. I mean, there is a lot there that we just, not only could we not, would we not get it past the pre-publication review, I don't think there's, even when I was doing interviews, even off the record stuff, those are close hold secrets. You know, you're not even going to talk about that stuff off the record, right? Like,
yeah.
So there's just, those were areas we just chose to completely avoid. Someday down the road, I hope somebody is able to tackle that.
Well, those stories don't get told unless somebody advocates, right? I mean, it just, it never happens because the goddamn government's never going to do it.
No.
For sure. Like, it reminds me of, you mentioned one character, Hall, but how many people know who Hedy Lamarr is? She was actually in Hollywood. Not one motherfucker has ever even tried to make a movie about her story, about how she wrote down the basic programming logic for frequency hopping radios on the back of a cocktail napkin, mm-hmm. right? In a fucking bar somewhere. And changed warfare forever, right? Like before that, we were using DR8 reels, like cables and shit like that. And we were using static open channels to talk to each other. So we had to use, like, the Germans had Enigma. We had certain kinds of encryption systems that were okay, but they were easily breakable. That's where that Wendtalker story came from, if you remember that.
Yep.
Because they had broken all of our codes. And then all of a sudden, this woman, who is a fucking actress, just like, oh, you know what? I know math, and writes it down on the back of a cocktail napkin. Nobody's ever made, like, there have been some kind of shitty documentaries about it, but nobody's ever made like a biopic about it. It's weird as hell to me. You know what I mean?
Guys, you've been on the show before. You know we got some sponsors to put this shit wagon on the air. First and foremost, GhostBed.com/drinkingbros. You know they're still giving you 50% off everything in the entire store. They might do it all the way up until Biden gets out of there, D'Anthony. We'll see. They know we're in a recession. They know we're at record inflation right now, and they're trying to do the best they can to get you a brand new bedroom set for relatively cheap. 50% off when you use the promo code DRINKINGBROS at checkout, and that's on everything. That's on mattresses. That's on pillows. That's on the sheets. That's on the weighted blankets. It's on the covers if you're doing butt stuff. It's even on those brand new mattresses for RVs. Let's go, dude. If you've seen those commercials pop up on your social media feed, they're pumping the new RV mattresses. Anybody with an RV out there, you know they give you shitty mattresses when you buy the goddamn thing, even though you're spending 90 grand on an RV. Head on over to GhostBed.com/drinkingbros today. Get yourself a new mattress for that RV or your bedroom. Highly recommend that adjustable base. I'm not going back. I've had that goddamn thing for 4 to 5 years now. Best in the biz. Love, love every product from GhostBed.com/drinkingbros. And right now, all their mattresses are made in the good old U.S. of A. Now, when you check out, you're not only going to use the promo code DRINKINGBROS, but maybe you're checking that box of the 3-year pay-as-you-go program to stretch it out over 3 years. Load up the cart as high as it'll go. They're forced to give you everything for 50% off and stretch it out for 3 years. And that's where the real deals come in, brother. Go to GhostBed.com/drinkingbros today. Get yourself a brand new bedroom set. Next up, we got BubsNaturals.com. Promo code DRINKINGBROS. Going to get you 20% off over there. Choosing the name Bubs for the brand came easy to Sean and his business partner, TJ, as the brand stands for Improving Overall Health and Wellness. And Glenn Bub Doherty always was on the mission to find the fountain of youth. He loved adventure and he loved living a healthy lifestyle. That's why they've got the best collagen protein on the planet. Bubs is truly unflavored, exceedingly soluble, better than the other guys. Per serving, 20 grams of protein, 7 essential amino acids, 1 single ingredient. They also got the best MCT oil powder on the planet over there. It'll be your new favorite functional coffee creamer. It's vegan, if you give a shit about that, and keto friendly, which is great. Pop a couple scoops into your coffee every single morning and go on your way. Bubs Naturals is a tribute to former Navy SEAL Glenn Bub Doherty. Laid down his life saving Americans in Benghazi. His call sign, the Navy, was Bub, and he stood for self-improvement, and he was always helping others. That DNA is woven into the Bubs brand. Bubs donates 10% of all profits to charity in Glenn's honor, starting with the Glenn Doherty Memorial Foundation. On Veterans Day, they give you 100% of the proceeds. All of them go to the Glenn Doherty Foundation. Head on over to BubsNaturals.com today. Use the promo code DRINKINGBROS for 20% off at checkout. I also love their apple vinegar gummies. That's just a personal fave of mine over there. Next up, we got Manscaped.com. Always the best copy in the business here. Always the best copy in the biz for Manscaped.com. This episode is brought to you by Manscaped. You know, One man every hour, every day is diagnosed with testicular cancer. In fact, testicular cancer is most common form of cancer amongst men age 15 to 35. And with April being National Testicular Cancer Awareness Month, our friends over at Manscaped have partnered with the Testicular Cancer Society to help spread awareness for men's health and early cancer detection. Visit manscaped.com/TCS to learn how to check yourself for early signs of cancer. And as always, use the promo code DRINKINBROS for 20% off plus free shipping over at manscaped.com. I like how even though they're doing a serious subject matter, they still put check yourself in there.
Yeah, well.
And it's yo with an apostrophe.
You don't want to wreck yourself.
Sure don't. Sure don't. So let's take a second to talk about some men's health issues that are important to me. Cancer prevention screening is extremely important. Obviously, my father just went through it and ended up being prostate for him. Got to check the front as well as the back, boys. With this in mind, you can perform simple self-routine checks at home while enjoying Manscaped products you use every day. So let's say you're using that Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra down there and you feel a lump. All right, go get checked out. Makes sense, right? They use products daily, these will help keep all your testicle area safe down there. The Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra features two interchangeable skin-safe blade heads, a standard one for taking a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth and sleek. They got dual LED spotlights that'll help you achieve better visibility, making every trim more precise and hassle-free. If you don't like making a mess, this thing is waterproof as well. Shave in the shower, in the bath, or in the ocean if you need to, or some dirty old river. If you're out in Flint, one of those dirty old rivers out there, you can head on down there and use it. And you can bring the trimmer wherever you go, thanks to its wireless charging capabilities and travel lock feature. In addition to providing the right tools and solutions for comfortable and easy grooming, Manscaped is committed to raising awareness and giving support to fighters, survivors, and families impacted by testicular cancer. That's why they will be donating $50,000 to the Testicular Cancer Society. Help save lives and balls by heading over to manscaped.com/TCS. and sharing their funny, educational check yourself video. And while you're at it, grab 20% off plus free shipping with the code DRINKINBROS. Because like a famous American philosopher once said, take care of your mentals, your balls, and your chickens. I don't know who said that. I don't know who said that.
Abraham Lincoln.
Did he really?
I don't know.
God damn it. What a great man. What a great man. Last but not least here today, we got bioproteintech.com. Promo code DRINKINBROS for $30 off your first order over there. Guys, here's why your hormones suck. If you're listening to this, and chances are you may be one of the countless men who are struggling to see results they want in the gym, in the mirror, or even in the bedroom. Most guys are focused on testosterone. However, that's only 50% of the answer. Without adequate growth hormone and its end result growth factors, you can't even optimally absorb the testosterone you have. No matter if it's synthetic or natural, that's where BioPro Plus comes in. BioPro Plus fills in what you're missing out on to help maximize your performance in the gym and even how you look in the mirror without any of the needles, side effects, or doctor visits, all at a fraction of the cost of the synthetic treatments. BioPro Plus is getting real guys, real results, really fast. Head on over to bioproteintech.com to learn more or click the link in our bio, the audio description, and use the code DRINKINBROS for $30 off your first order. If you want to fix the way you perform, look, and feel without all the risk of big pharma synthetic bullshit, go to bioproteintech.com. Use that promo code DRINKINBROS for $30 off your first order. Dan and I have been using it for about 6 months. All you do is pop a vial underneath your tongue right before night-night. You feel a little sting to it and you know that it's working. They don't talk about how great your skin is on it, but my skin is really improved using this over the last 6 months. So super big fan of these guys and love what they do. Yeah. And when you said 25 to 50 years, Marty, is that the anticipated dates of getting some of this stuff declassified?
I think you just typically look at anything that's at a top secret level. I think the minimum waiting period is 25 years. Joe, are you able to speak to that more?
Yeah, I remember from my, you know, the standard training you have to do every year, but I think 25 to 50 is generally right. I mean, the signals intelligence stuff that she was doing with the NSA is super technical and pretty close hold. I mean, we made our best effort to really focus on the things that were unique about her career, because there's the technical aspect is interesting, but it wasn't as unique as Shannon being on the ground level. And so a lot of that, I think, has already been declassified. So we focused heavily on that. And it's also for people who are really interested in, you know, special operations and the global war on terror. I don't think the story has really been told yet on how we hunt down humans. You always hear about, hey, what happens when we run these guys down and we go put a charge in the door and we, you know, blow in the door and kill everybody. That story gets told over and over again because it's the big sexy stuff. But how we actually meticulously hunt humans really hasn't been talked about before, how we go out there and have to blend in amongst the populations and put these guys in time and space, and how we get this information, in particular from human sources using linguistic abilities. That hasn't been told. So I think we focused really heavily on that and the scenes that we create and we recreate in particular, which I think people will find pretty interesting.
How old are your children right now?
They are 7 and 9.
At what age do you think, and maybe you've already determined it, that you'll be able to give this to them and say, here's who your mom is?
I'm just guessing, just based on really their reading ability, I think probably around 11 or 12. They're both pretty good readers. They both like to read. But as far as them being able to actually absorb it, I would assume somewhere 11 to 12, maybe 13-ish. Mm-hmm. And then I know they're going to have more questions that come up from there. They're going to do their own research, which is good, which is why one of the big reasons why I wrote the book. But yeah, it's crazy to say now because they were so young when she was killed. But it's coming up really soon here where they're going to have that book and they're going to have questions for me, which I both dread and look forward to all at the same time.
Yeah, that's why I ask. My son's turning 10 on Thursday, and the books that he's reading, yeah, he's able to completely absorb and understand all of it and ask thoughtful questions. And I thought to myself, well, your oldest has got to be right around that age. So, and they're curious. You know, even mine will look up things on the internet because I don't let them listen to Drinking Bros or watch any of the movies I've ever done, to be honest with you, because they're all disgusting and I'm a horrible person. But he'll go out and find them on his own and find a picture somewhere and be like, hey, Dad, how do you know, you know, Post Malone or Donald Trump or something like that? And then you'll have to tell him from the show, but he's never been able to see it or watch it. Whereas this is a different story. It's a biography about their life. And I wondered what age they're prepared to read that.
Yeah, I mean, considering they're tragically, they already know how it ends. And that's probably the heaviest part of the book. But the rest of it is very, I mean, I'd say it's very age appropriate. As long as the kid can read it on their own, it's fine. But yeah, so I think probably, around 10, around 11, they're going to be reading this and probably asking me questions about it or able to retell her story on their own. Which again, that's another big reason why I really wanted to actually write the book and document this all. But yeah, it's coming up here soon.
Yeah, and that's truthfully one of my favorite parts of writing is leaving a story behind for years and years and years, because it's not just your kids. It'll be their kids as well, wanting to know about their grandmother and everything else. And then, boom, here it is. It's very rare that somebody gets a biography about their life done and done so well here. Marty, have you talked to Joe's kids at all?
I mean, I've met them. You know, Joe and I living on opposite coasts. It's not easy for me to be around, obviously. You know, I met them initially when I came out for the memorial. And then once more, I came out to Joe's place. I think it was a couple years ago now, for some stuff for the book. So I've met them. But no, I don't. You know, they never return my texts. I don't know why, Joe.
I'm taking cell phones away from them as long as possible.
Yeah,
you have to. But the reason I asked Marty is, you know, as they're heading into this age, one would think as an author, you would go back and say, hey, do you remember your mom? Can you tell me anything about her? Because it's one of those things where when a parent dies so young, you do wonder if they remember their mom or their dad or anything like that. And that's what I'm curious about. I guess just because I'm a father now of three, and I think back to when my kids were that age, I don't know that they would remember me at all. It's strange to ask, but yeah.
You know, they were one in three, as Joe said, when she died. So I don't expect that they'll have a lot of firsthand memories, but one of the most, I think powerful parts of the book is when Joe talks about reading to his boys and some of the things that they bring up about their mom. I don't want to spoil it or anything like that, but you know, people read it. I want them to get the full impact of that particular part of the book without me spoiling it on a podcast. But I know that they definitely, Joe and Heather have done such an amazing job from what I can see of, including and making sure Shannon is a big part of their life. But also, you know, I've got two young daughters myself, and the second one literally her middle name is after Shannon, and both of them have grown up now. They're both young, 3 and 9. They've, you know, the last 5 years, they've grown up with dad's working on a book. Dad's working on, like, what's this about? And so even my daughters know quite a bit about Shannon Kent at this point, just because this is what dad has been working on for as long as they can remember. I think it's definitely going to be something. And part, again, too, like they're both, Joe's got two boys. I've got two daughters, and this is who I want them to be, you know, their role model. Like role model number one is Shannon Kent for my daughters. Everything that she did and represents is what I want my daughters to aspire to be.
Yeah. I wonder about that, from both of your perspectives, actually, because I wonder how you'd balance the honor of her service and sacrifice with the bad side of American foreign policy, right? What we've done negatively to our country, the pointlessness of the Iraq war, the pullout in Afghanistan, the continued bullshit that we're doing. Because I could see two boys who are who see their mother as a war hero, or two little girls who are her namesake, right? Wanted to dedicate themselves to some kind of service similar to that as well. But from my perspective personally, I would probably discourage any kids I had from joining the U.S. military at this point because of the way that it's being leveraged in an unethical way, in my opinion. So like how do you, I guess, have you thought about that at all? And then what's your plan to deal with it as it comes? Because, you know, teenage boys start to think about that kind of shit.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it and I've talked about it and spoken publicly about it quite a bit. I mean, the books in me is apolitical. It's really just a biography about Shannon's life, which most people, now that I'm kind of a public political person, they don't believe it, but it truly is. There's no politics in it whatsoever. But Shannon was killed a month after Trump gave the order for our troops to be pulled out of Syria the first time. So, I mean, that entire backstory and the way that it tragically culminated, it's highly political, and it still is to this day. I mean, we've got troops right now because of what happened, you know, 24 hours ago in Syria. We got troops in Syria and Iraq and Jordan that could be under fire right now, and they should have been out of there a very, very long time ago. But I agree with you. I mean, I have the struggle myself, and I've had it really for the last couple of years. Like, do I tell my kids to go in the military? I mean, my oldest already has decided that he wants to be a Marine Corps sniper. Shannon's younger brother just retired from the Marines from MARSOC. When I was his age, I had my mind made up that I wanted to be a commando of some sort too. So it's literally in his DNA. That's a big reason why I want to be in the political sphere, so that we can fix these issues, so we're not sending our military off to go fight and die in pointless wars. But I agree. I'm torn too. I mean, the book is really for them to get to know their mom, but there is a lot of, you know, my politics. And I talk about it all the time, too, because I think it plays such a huge factor in American politics, whether you're interested in foreign policy or not. But I agree with you. And it's a horrible place to be in, because if you would have asked me you know, 5-6 years ago, a decade ago, I would encourage any young person to go into the military. Whereas now, I honestly, I say this and I genuinely mean it. People ask me, like, what's the hardest question you get on the campaign trail? Is it, you know, about abortion? Is it about Donald Trump or any of that stuff? It's not. It's when a young person comes up to me and says, I've wanted to be in the military all my life. What should I do? And that's hard because I feel torn between two worlds of like a guy who had a really positive experience in the military, but then also a part of me that understands at a more mature level the way that that's really been abused by our political class for their gain.
Yeah, there's something to be said about, well, a couple of things. The legacy recruits are gone now, right? Because they're, like you said, maybe 5 years ago is accurate, maybe 15 or 20 is more accurate, but there was a time when adult veterans would have actively encouraged their children to join the military, like walk them down to the recruiting station even.
Yep.
Like, hey, you're not fucking living in my house at 19, bud. You're done. So you can get a job or you're joining the military. That's kind of how it used to be. And it's not anymore, right? And it, like, I get calls from people like consultants and shit in DC all the time asking about this stuff, about the quote-unquote recruiting crisis. I don't think we have a recruiting crisis. You have a messaging problem, right?
Yeah.
Because you've lied to these motherfuckers. You sent them to war for 25 years, and when they got home, you told them, good luck, right? And all this stuff. It's like, you can convince 17 to 19-year-olds to do stuff, but when their 45-year-old dad is like, no, then it's over,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty much over at that point. So I don't think there's a recruiting crisis. I think there's a trust crisis, and it's a good thing that there's a trust crisis because they don't deserve our trust, right? Now, Amen. The solution to that is not to abandon the country. It's to get those motherfuckers out of there so we can trust our system again and apply this natural aggression that we have in a positive way again for the betterment of our country and humanity and shit like that. Yeah, it's like, it seems like a pretty simple concept to me, but you know, at this point, behind the scenes, they're talking about a draft in 2026. I'm not sure if you're tracking on this, but the Army is getting ready to activate the IRR and bring up like tens of thousands of people because they're worried about having to institute a draft.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you privy to that, Joe?
I mean, I know probably what Dan knows just from reading the news. I've seen that they're also considering bringing back retirees, which as a retiree, I'm like, okay, that's going to be interesting when they send me this letter. But look, I mean, years ago when Biden came in and he really forced the COVID mandate, but then also the extremist stand down where they said, hey, I think if you had a Gadsden flag on your Facebook profile, you might be an extremist. We're going to suspend your security clearance. When they started doing all this, between that and what took place with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I knew guys that were, you know, over the 10-year mark, that were at the 15-year mark, the 20-year mark, who probably would have stayed in until they got kicked out, that were like, I'm done. And when you saw that retention crisis take place, right after that was the recruiting crisis. But at the same time, you've got Joe Biden, who wants to get us involved in potentially a major land war in Europe, wants to get us involved in another war in the Middle East, potentially the Pacific. It's like, those two things don't make any sense. You can't gut your military and then try and start a war on every single corner of the globe and then think that you're not going to have the draft. It's foreign, I think, to our generation because we've never had a draft. We fought our nation's longest war literally with an all-volunteer force. So I think we're about to come head on with a very, very unfortunate and unpleasant reality. And you know what? At this point, if we had to at least, I wouldn't want us to draft people and send them off to war. But if we had to, you know, start calling up people and saying, well, now we're going to draft you into the military, that might make more people care about why we're going to war.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, the Constitution doesn't authorize a standing army anyways, Joe. It authorizes a Navy to protect our transportation and shipping. Yeah. The end.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Founders are smart guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I've talked about this a million times on this show. There's a very good reason not to have a standing army, and it's because of the Powell Doctrine, right? Like, you need to be able to have to go to war, you should have the will of the public, right? You should have a clear and defined end state as well. Like, and we haven't had any of that shit for any of this. So as a matter of fact, the president, no matter who they are, keeps sending troops into combat without even asking Congress for it, right? So,
Amen.
I mean, we're like two layers deep in this bullshit at a minimum. There should be a Navy and probably a Marine Corps element, I guess, if you want to call it that, whether it doesn't matter what you call it. Their job is to fucking be on ships and Muse and shit and rapidly deploy to places that should they need to, right, to protect our transportation and shipping. But
and that power is supposed to reside with Congress, because Congress is the closest representative body to the American people.
Yeah.
However, you get Congress, just Republicans and Democrats alike, that will just sign the checks that let the president send us off the war. And that's been taking place for pretty much our entire adult lives. And that's really got to get reined back in. People don't realize how much that affects their daily lives. I hope we don't have to have the draft to wake them up. But at the same time, like our foreign policy and the way that we've given the executive branch a blank check to do this, like they're going to run head on into each other very soon.
Yeah, and I talked to Jared about this too. The other problem with recruitment in the military is there's almost a hero problem, is what I like to call it. You don't have anybody really to look up to, you know, for females like Shannon Kent. This is a great story. This is somebody that you should push to the forefront and encourage young women who want to join the military to be like her and give somebody to look up to. But instead, we're getting dudes who are now girls in the Biden administration. And you see more of them on a daily basis, to the point where I had to ask you the other day, who is that person wearing the decked out?
The Health and Human Services dude.
Yeah. But that's who most people, you know, civilian like me, thinks is in the military. Yeah. Where I had to ask Dan live on air. I was like, wait a minute, that person never served? Why are they wearing all that shit in every goddamn photo with the president everywhere you go? That's not somebody you would aspire to look up to and say, yeah, I want to join the military and be like that dude.
Yeah, like, it matters who our heroes are in culture, right? It's the basest form of aspirational marketing, I guess, because you can sit a kid down and tell them why it's wrong to steal and hate people because of their immutable characteristics, or why it's a good thing to serve your community, take care of people and such. It's another thing entirely to see a human being that actually does it and be like, you know what, I'm gonna make a choice to be like that person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you see the person in their life, and what you glean from it are the principles that they live by, and that becomes your North Star, right? But when the heroes in culture are people who turn the camera around on themselves, right? And it's all about me, me, me. Then we get a culture of it's all about me. That's just how it works, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've dug this hole for ourselves. But the good news is, and I say this all the time too, I don't like all this doom and gloom shit. Any problem you create, you can fucking fix. Because if you had the power to create it, you have the power to fix it. And how you fix that is by doing stuff like this. Elevating people who actually are good human beings instead of retards on the internet, you know, who are just like going for dopamine hits from attention and shit like that. And then make the point that this is the kind of person we need. So you got to go be this person, right? Like, Shannon's gone now. We need the next Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it fucking works, right? Next man up. This is something that athletes talk about. It's something that we train for in the military all the time. Know the job of the dude above and below you. It's just part of it, right? So this is the solution to all of this. The ills of modern Western culture lie solely in that, in who we decide to put on a pedestal and who we don't, right?
Yeah. And with you, Joe, you know, running for Congress, I actually want to see you in there to see what you can do, to see if you can make a difference. Again, we've had a ton of politicians on this show, and I genuinely believe in you because we need that element as well. And you've got to have somebody besides Dan Crenshaw in there who's going to represent the military in a positive way for Congress. I don't know if you've had any conversations with him or reached out to him or vice versa or how that works. But do you guys chat behind the scenes, other guys who are in the military who are in Congress, like Marcus Luttrell, for example? You ever chat with him?
I've met Marcus's older brother, who's I can't remember if he's older or younger, but he's in Congress. I've met him a couple of times. Morgan Luttrell.
Morgan, yes.
Eli Crane, another great. He's a freshman this year, but former SEAL. he's just doing phenomenal things in Congress. If you look at his voting record, you look at the stances he's taken, especially on fiscal responsibility. He actually put the measure on the floor, him and Matt Gaetz, Ana Paulina Luna, and Corey Mills, to get our troops out of Iraq and Syria, Libya, and Yemen earlier this year. And actually had those, had that bill gone through and not gotten killed off by the Uniparty, we wouldn't have lost those three soldiers just a couple months ago defending the tri-border region of Iraq, Syria, and Jordan. So yeah, I talked to quite a few of those guys. We are starting to get more, I think, global war on terror vets that are in Congress. In particular, this last freshman class had some, had some really good ones. The folks I just mentioned, they're all veterans, and I think that they're by and large doing the right thing in Congress and just saying, hey, we don't really care what the Uniparty wants. We're going to go represent our constituents. But then they have a really powerful and impactful voice when it comes to, you know, how and why our country uses force.
Yeah, and there's others as well. Tim Sheehy up in Montana is another guy,
okay,
who's running for office right now. That is,
yeah.
You know, he, I'd like to fuck with him and call him a politician, and he always like, no, no, no. I'm like, all right, we'll see. But yeah, there are good people. And look, I don't necessarily think that loading up Congress with veterans specifically is the right call, because you get a Dan Crenshaw here and there, right?
Yeah, but
he's a total piece of shit.
I forget who the there was a guest a few weeks ago, and you said, I feel like you should have had to have served if you're going to make the decision to send other people's kids to war.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, like, but service doesn't just mean the military, right? Like, you should have to. To me, it's something that goes on in high school. This is kind of an aside, I guess, but. Like, right now, the public education system tries to, for the first time in their lives, teach children a new language at 13 or 14 years old. You know how difficult that is to learn a new language when you're a fucking teenager?
Yeah.
It's fucking stupid. Move that shit back to first grade, right?
Mm-hmm.
First through third grade, and where they can actually learn the language, and then make the requirement for high school, instead of two full fucking years, four semesters of a foreign language, public service to your community. Right now, these people know what it means to sacrifice. They know the essential, secret of life, that it's not about you, that every meaningful thing you do in life will be in the service of other people. And then you're not so ready to throw lives away because of your fucking wallet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My rule of thumb is, if your answer to every single crisis throughout the world is to send in the troops or to leave the troops there forever, then I'm going to need you to go ahead and serve like in the infantry as an enlisted dude. There's plenty of guys out there who don't have any background in service who I think have pretty pragmatic takes, and they understand just pattern recognition that, look, the last 20 years of war got us absolutely nothing. What we're hearing right now about Ukraine is absolute insanity, and they're voting in the right direction. So it doesn't have to be veterans, but I do think getting more folks in there who were honest about the experiences we had in the war on terror, and just like, look, it wasn't successful. We do need to chart a new course. I think that's something we should strive towards.
One of the biggest topics that's come up here for this election in particular is obviously immigration. If you were in with this border funding bill that they're trying to jam through, with funding for Ukraine as well as Israel, how do you stop that? Being in Congress is just one guy, and what are the conversations you would have to have behind the scenes? Because I think that's what a lot of people are curious about. Because it seems like, besides Trump, nobody else wants to go to war, nobody else wants to fund this shit, but the Republicans we currently have in there are still voting on this shit, like Mike Johnson and those guys, and they won't give up this funding for these wars, and I don't know why. Well, I mean, I do know why, but,
Just watch. These guys they've been on, 2 weeks for Easter break. I don't know who gets 2 weeks for Easter break, but, you know, your congressmen do. When they come back next Monday, they are going to have their hair on fire to try and sign off on the Senate bill that was $95 billion of new foreign aid, the majority of which goes to Ukraine, more goes to Israel, Taiwan, and then, you know, a couple more billion to keep us deeply involved in the war in the Middle East. That somehow is going to be their number one priority when we literally have critical pieces of infrastructure that are falling into the ocean, you know, like we just had in Maryland recently. So, and we have an invasion on our southern border. I mean, we've lost troops defending other countries' borders in, you know, just a couple months ago, but we have an invasion on our southern border. To answer your question, Congress has to draw a hard line and say, look, as long as the president is using the funding that we give him to facilitate an invasion on our southern border, we just simply won't fund the government. That's exactly why 2 weeks ago, when they put forward that monstrosity, that $1.2 trillion omnibus bill, you had the majority of Republicans, and not just the Freedom Caucus. You even had some really middle of the road Republicans who said, I can't do this. I can't continue to fund this if we're not not going to secure the border, I won't fund the government. And that bill, even though Republican leadership put it on the floor, it passed with the majority of Democrats voting for it, not Republicans. So the one little piece of leverage that Congress has, it's the purse strings. And in a case like this, I think they've got to be incredibly draconian and harsh and just say, like, you know what? Until you're ready to shut down the border, we're not even going to come back to Washington, D.C. We're not talking about anything. We most certainly are not talking about sending billions of dollars to foreign countries until that's taken care of. And then after that, it just goes back down to the individual discipline of doing individual appropriations bills. When they had that speaker fight over who was going to be the speaker, and then they got rid of McCarthy, the media said that was all because a bunch of crazy guys want to burn the whole place down. Really, one of their biggest complaints was that we keep doing these massive spending packages and we're not doing individual bills the way the Constitution dictates. And that's just basic good fiscal policy. So get back to that and prioritize, you know, the security of the United States of America. I think it's pretty common sense.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how we're going to secure our border when we have to secure the borders of Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Tunisia, and Oman, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we've priorities matter.
Yeah. Yeah, they sure do. What do we send, $480 million over there?
Yeah. $380 for those guys. That's part of that bill anyways. I think the federal government, I think like maybe Congress to some degree, but mostly the fucking unelected bureaucrats are terrified of a government shutdown because people are going to see how little they need the federal government in their lives. That's the
agree.
It's like was it Brave New World where or let's say Equilibrium, the movie, because this is a better example, where he doesn't take his fucking Soma pill for one day and he starts seeing how the real world is.
Mm-hmm.
That little fucking ray of sunlight into people's lives where they see how useless the federal government is the biggest fear of anybody that's a fucking career bureaucrat, I think, because that's their whole livelihood, right, is extracting labor and wealth from the population. And once people see for like even a week, even turning it off for a week, right, where they're like, oh, that didn't change my life at all.
Yeah.
Fuck. Why is 40% of my money coming out and going to these assholes then?
Yeah, and even Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was on the show right before Christmas break, you know, she was talking about shut it down. Like, great, you want to shut the government down? Like, we deserve it. This deserves to be shut down because these bills are awful that we're jamming through. That $1.2 trillion omnibus bill, was it over 1,200 pages, less than 48 hours to read, which nobody can do that.
Nobody read that.
No.
No one who voted for that, maybe some people in leadership, but the vast majority who voted for it, they didn't read it. I mean, it's just a slap in the face of the American people. We're $35 trillion in debt. The border's open. You're right. I mean, we got to draw a strong line and just, if you're not going to fund the border, if you're not going to defend the country, just shut it down.
Yeah, I agree. Listen, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. This is the point in the show we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. We'll start with you first, Joe. Who would you like to give drinking bro of the week to?
Oops, sorry, I was on mute.
No worries.
Drinking bro of the week. You know, just recently I lost a very good friend of mine, Josh Rosen. He was also a friend of Shannon's. He served in the military for 24 years, was a Green Beret, deployed all over the world, just tragically lost him to cancer, likely from the burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Josh and his family, his son's named after me, my son's named after him, and then his wife, Jenny. So those are my drinking bros of the week.
Awesome. Marty?
I'm going to go with an organization rather than an individual person. My drinking bro of the week is Hunter 7 Foundation. Similar to what Joe was just talking about with losing a friend to cancer, I think that we are just at the very, very front of a very long problem that we are just now starting to wrap our heads around. And it's, if we didn't have folks like Hunter 7 Foundation getting people screened, doing the research to inform us on what we're facing, you know, I look back to 2006 and say, man, maybe I shouldn't have been sniffing the batteries that I was thrown into the burn pit when I was on those details and stuff. And maybe that bill's going to come due sooner rather than later, you know. And I know I'm not the only person in that situation. And if it weren't for Hunter 7 Foundation and, you know, there's some other good organizations fighting that fight as well. But they are ones that I particularly want to spotlight and say, hey, there's some folks worth supporting and doing really important work on behalf of the veteran population.
That's awesome. The book is called Send Me, The Incredible True Story of a Mother at War. It is available for pre-sale right now on Amazon. Kindle's out. Audiobook is available for pre-sale, and so is hardcover. The book drops on May 7th. I say this all the time on the show. Please keep in mind, when you buy these pre-sales, they count towards first week sales for the New York Times bestseller list. So please pre-order this book now. That will help get these guys on the New York Times bestseller list opening week. And it'll also give us a new hero that we desperately need in this world instead of the shit the government is forcing down our throats currently. Thank you for your time today. Both you guys are wonderful individuals. My only thing is, Marty, your face next to his face is going to be rough through a lot of these interviews for the next month, my man. You know?
I know. At least Joe is also tall, though, so I don't also have to deal with my other insecurity, which is being like 3 feet taller than anybody else I'm ever on camera with. So I've got that going for me on this.
You're like an albino Shrek, you know? And because in real life, Marty, there's not many people. It's true, Joe. There's not many people I meet who are this giant. Like, people really underestimate how tall Marty is. He's a large man.
Marty's very tall. Yeah. I'm like 6'2". I think Marty's like 6'5".
Well, being up in the Pacific Northwest, any chance you think he's Bigfoot?
It's. I won't rule it out. Let's just say that.
Bigfoot with alopecia, maybe?
Never seen in the same room.
He's got, and you are kind of blurry too, which is like Bigfoot's character, or his main characteristic is.
Yeah, blurry, so. I feel like I'm watching the Patterson film every time I talk to you on Zoom, Marty. Come into the studio, all right? We love you guys. We appreciate you being on. Again, the book is called Send Me, The Incredible True Story of a Mother at War. Please pre-order this now. Good luck in the upcoming election. We'll be live that night on Drinking Bros as we are for every single election, and we'll be rooting for you. Hopefully you get it done this year, man. 2,600 votes. Let's get out there and vote, Washington, all right?
Absolutely.
God damn it. We need more people like you in office. For D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros Podcast. Good night, everyone.